tell me what the body without organs is, or I'll kill you, is a meme online because Deleuze and Guattari are very difficult, right? And so, I mean, at this point, it's the meme is how difficult they actually are. And then there's this question as to whether they're even worth it. Well, at Theory Underground, we think it's worthwhile. Not only can you not understand theory in the 21st century without understanding what they accomplished, but you also can't really be a Lacanian if you don't know how you disagree with this fundamental critique. Now, I'm not saying that theory that is defined by Lacan versus Deleuze is the be-all end-all. There's a lot more to theory, and there's a lot more to understanding our situation than what those two approaches make possible. But you cannot understand the scene we are in today without understanding these thinkers. And that's very frustrating. A lot of people don't have the time, energy for that kind of thing. And that's why Theory Underground exists. And so what you're about to see, this conversation with Brent Adkins, is from an epic marathon live stream that happened at this point like a month and a half ago. I think that there's a lot of gems here and a lot of really fantastic stuff if you're trying to understand why somebody would be into Deleuze in the first place and what their criticisms of people like Lacan or Hegel or Heidegger might be. So I really like Brent. I think his work here is amazing. If you haven't checked out his introduction to, or sort of reader's guide to, A Thousand Plateaus, if you're ever going to read A Thousand Plateaus, definitely pick up his work on that, as well as maybe some of the other works that he has written that we talk about in this episode. With that, I'll just say two quick points of order. And the first one is that I am officially freed from Amazon. At the time that this was being recorded, I was still an Amazon employee. Now I'm doing Theory Underground full time. And so I just have to say thank you so much to my subscribers and patrons. You know who you are, and I'll shout you out at the end of this video. Also, if people are interested in getting involved with Theory Underground, there's more information at the end of this video. And then finally, the next epic marathon live stream will be on May 18th, 2024. And that's pretty much like a week before we depart for Europe for the Theory Underground European tour. Stay tuned for more information on that. There's already a little bit of information on it at theoryunderground.com, but there's plenty more info to come if you are looking to link up with us on the tour. We're really looking forward to being welcomed into Europe. It feels great. We're really excited to talk about our books, talk about the research, talk about the courses, and just to connect with people who are excited about big ideas, rigorous thinking, and doing stuff that has a sort of fidelity to the idea of the university and the, which is to say, the idea of the universal, but who can't seem to find it at their academic institutions. All right. Enjoy the interview. We're back. Welcome, everybody, to the show, I guess, to the epic marathon live stream at Theory Underground. I'm David McCarricker, and you are all familiar with Nance here. But we're excited to introduce you all, if you're not familiar with his work already, Dr. Brent Adkins. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really great to have you. You've got a bunch of books that look totally fascinating, such as A Guide to Ethics and Moral Philosophy, Rethinking Philosophy and Theology with Deleuze, A New Cartography, True Freedom, Spinoza's Practical Philosophy. And then it looks like the first one that's available, at least on my end of things, is Death and Desire in Hegel, Heidegger, and Deleuze. And that one, which I only found out about this week, really looks fascinating because I'm very interested in all three of these thinkers. But I think the reason that we all know about you, several of us here at Theory Underground, is because of your amazing book you published in 2015 called Deleuze and Guattari's A Thousand Plateaus, A Critical Introduction and Guide. And so today is Deleuze's birthday. And Yay. Yeah. happy birthday to Guy Deleuze. Well, welcome to the stream. You're the official real Deleuzian scholar that we've had on the stream. And so this is a very special occasion. I guess as a sort of introduction to you and also through you, him, maybe you could say a few things about your own philosophical journey, getting into philosophy, your discovery of Deleuze, and what brought you to write that book.
Yeah, sure. Really happy to be here. And the journey was strange. So I actually started in theology, numerous versions of this story. The short version is, it just looked to me like theology was bad philosophy. So I started doing philosophy in graduate school after graduating with my theology degree. And my first love was Derrida. My master's thesis was on Derrida. And like like many scholars, there's a tendency towards scholasticism. So, you know, you find somebody you like and you want to know, oh, what are their sources? And so you do these deep dives into all the obscurities and stuff. And so that was the move that I made in my PhD program, which was, what are Derrida's sources? And I zeroed in on Hegel and Heidegger and wrote my dissertation on Hegel and Heidegger. And so I was aware of Deleuze in that process, but never really looked at him. I was much more into Derrida and his relation to Hegel and Heidegger. And I came across Deleuze a couple of times. I think I took a seminar on Lacan and his critics, where we read a little Deleuze from Anti-Oedipus. But yeah, just wasn't on my radar at all. And so I got my position here at Rona College, and I thought, well, you know, what does one do when one takes their dissertation and turns it into a book? The problem was, I wasn't really crazy about my dissertation. I didn't think it really went anywhere. I just thought it came to an impasse. You know, it was Hegel and Heidegger on death, and their position seemed incommensurable with one another, and I didn't really have any non-question begging way to prefer one over the other. So it just sort of ended. And so I was sort of searching around, and I was becoming more interested in Deleuze, and my path into Deleuze was actually through Spinoza. I started teaching Spinoza pretty regularly and was using Deleuze to help me understand Spinoza and Spinoza to help me understand Deleuze. And so I took the big step of putting Anti-Oedipus on a syllabus, because I tried several times to do something with it and they all failed. And I thought, well, if I'm going to figure it out, I'm just going to have to put it on a syllabus and have to figure it out in real time in front of students or go down in flames. And so that's what I did. And I thought it worked pretty well. And I began to piece together an understanding. And not only that, I thought there might be a path out of the impasse with Hegel and Heidegger through Deleuze. And so that ended up being the Death and Desire book, which is basically my dissertation rewritten with Deleuze at the end. And I could say more about sort of the argument there, what I'm pursuing there, but you know, the entire text is available on my academia page, if anybody wants to take a look, as are not full texts of all my books, but full texts of some books and partial texts of other books. And so, yeah, I had a conversion. Deleuze was the man. I was done with all of this talk about the negative and the nothing, and I was really into desire and production and creativity. And so I started pursuing Deleuze and hanging out with Deleuzians, and they were super cool in a way that Hegelians and Heideggerians weren't. And so, yeah, I just sort of made my path from there. And I developed a good relationship with the editor at Edinburgh, who published the first book, and asked if they would be interested in a book on 1,000 plateaus, because it was sort of starting to piece that together. And they said, sure. And so I wrote that. And yeah, I've been very pleased with the response to the book. And it gets me invitations like this. So I'm very happy to have taken this path.
Yeah, this book is an absolute treasure and has been foundational for unlocking 1,000 plateaus, probably for, I don't know, I want to say millions, but let's be honest, it's probably a few thousand. Yeah. But in my mind, it's millions.
Yes, and there are dozens of us, dozens.
Yeah, dozens of us. Well, you know, at least a few hundred more than there would have been, I'm sure. And that's because really at the end of the day, unless someone has the time, the energy, the resources, and that's not even enough. You actually, resources, we have to have an institution. We actually have to have some kind of a vehicle for teaching it to learn it. Like, that's the thing is, you know, I see people struggling to just read a book like that, 1,000 plateaus, in isolation. And it's like, not only, you know, you had been going at it for so long, but it was that kind of that leap of faith saying, no, I'm going to teach it. And if I don't, you know, and trial by fire, and it forced you knowing it. So,
yeah, I mortgaged my students' future for my own benefit there, but it ended up paying off.
Well, it's, so 1,000 plateaus, very difficult book. You wrote this critical introduction and guide to it. And maybe you could say a few more things about the structure, some of the key concepts that you chose to focus on. You know, obviously you can't take on the whole book, but kind of like, what do you kind of see just as, you know, it's Deleuze's birthday. So giving people advice, people who want to dive in the deep end here. What's some of the advice you would give them, and kind of what is your sort of key to unlocking this text?
My key to unlocking the text is a kind of an offhanded sentence from the first plateau where they call the book a perceptual semiotics. And this to me is absolutely crucial because I think it militates against a very common reading of particularly 1,000 plateaus, which is, oh, yes, Deleuze is separating the wheat from the chaff. He's separating the sheep from the goats. And the terms that he uses are tree and rhizome, or state and war machine, you know, or any of the other dichotomies. And so the purpose of 1,000 plateaus on this reading, this common reading, would be to say, okay, well, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? Who are the trees and who are the rhizomes? And let's be more like rhizomes and less like trees. And I think what Deleuze and Guattari are arguing is not that at all. I take that to be a moral reading of 1,000 plateaus, when everything in all of their works suggests that they would, they're aiming for an ethical reading rather than a moral reading, right? And by ethical, I mean, in the straightforwardly Spinozist sense, that the task of ethics is to figure out which combinations are composing and which are decomposing. And so for Deleuze and Guattari, the task is not to find the good rhizomes and eliminate the bad trees. The task is to recognize that everything can be seen as a rhizome. Okay, well, what does it mean to see something as a rhizome? Well, it means to see it without essence. It means to see it as capable of change. It means to see it as a vector for invention. And so for Deleuze and Guattari, even the most arborescent structure can be examined and understood in terms of where its edges are, where it's likely to change. And for them, that's interesting. That's where invention occurs. And so how I read 1,000 plateaus is not this not this metaphysics where they're laying everything out. They're saying, look, if you thought of things this way, these are the kinds of things you could invent. Now go invent new things, right? So it's more a series of illustrations or examples about how to create, how to invent, rather than it is a sort of new totalizing metaphysics.
And then Deleuze, though, had a metaphysics. Maybe it wasn't this totalizing metaphysics, but, you know, the basic sort of the virtual, intensive, extensive, you know, way of thinking of, about how things come into being, which is, you know, developed, at least for me. I mean, I've only really read Difference and Repetition prior to Anti-Oedipus and A Thousand Plateaus. I haven't read The Logic of Sense or any of his lectures yet. But I'm wondering if maybe you could say a few things about what is done, what is working with Guattari and writing these books ultimately do with his metaphysics. And maybe we can use that as a bridge into talking about the body without organs. Because you have to tell us what that is.
Which they famously disagree on. So.
Okay.
Yeah, we may be in for a long conversation there. So, of course, I wouldn't deny that Deleuze has a metaphysics. And I agree that it is a metaphysics, to put this in the most sort of blunt, straightforward terms as possible, it is a metaphysics in which things arise out of chaos, right? So it's not as if order is imposed on chaos from without, right? This is the judgment of God, he would call it. He's trying to account for the way in which chaos itself is self-organizing. And so you can imagine like a sine wave, and above a level, you have extensity, right? You have things formed into what we would call objects. And that, for the most part, has been what philosophy has focused on Deleuze's reading. And he's not interested in that at all. What he's interested in is that prior intensive process that produces these stable objects. And so that's why he's so interested in what he would call the anomalous or the deterritorializing edge, right? Where are those inflection points where something is likely to change? That's what defines an object, not some sort of unchanging essence. And so what does Guattari bring to the table? I think Guattari brings a lot, and I think it's been underappreciated. It's being more and more appreciated, but and you know, we could point to things that Deleuze says. You know, he says that Felix was this sort of unending fount of invention. Like, he never stopped inventing things, and Felix was often upset with Gilles because he moved so slowly that by the time he got around to sort of thinking about, you know, this thing that Felix had invented, he was on to the next thing and was inventing more and more stuff. And so you do get this sort of, I don't know, this effervescence I find in both Anti-Oedipus and A Thousand Plateaus that's not quite there in the other works. But beyond that, you know, beyond sort of a kind of shift in style, you do have a much more straightforward political engagement. And, you know, of the two, Felix was much more politically engaged than Deleuze. And this goes back to his work as a practicing clinician at Laborde Clinic. And the work they were doing there was institutional analysis, right? It wasn't individual analysis. So all therapy was group therapy. There were no distinctions or very minor distinctions between sort of staff and patients at Laborde. Laborde had, you know, no walls, no doors. People came and go as they pleased. And so there's this real concern with what in other texts Deleuze would call the individual, as opposed to the individual, right? That's, you know, the individual isn't the basic unit of analysis for this kind of analysis, and not for Deleuze either. The basic unit of analysis is, you know, what forces are intersecting here, what forces are at play, and what sort of assemblage do they produce, and what are its anomalous edges, where can something new be produced? But I could ramble on that. I think I posted a recent article called Anti-Oedipus, Metaphysics and Method, that talks a lot about Guattari's contribution to the project. But anyway, I'm happy to say more, but I can also go on to something else there.
So the body without organs then is, right. Is that was the answer?
No, I didn't talk about body without organs at all.
Okay. Just making sure that wasn't the answer. Yeah.
No. Well, that was, what does Guattari bring to Deleuze and the writing of Deleuze?
Right.
And then I was pausing to see if you wanted to pursue that or go on to the fraught body without organs.
Well, I've got two questions from Michael Downs, who's also a huge fan of your work. I have to say, like, a lot of what I initially got for in terms of DNG come through Mikey. So we'll want to get into those for sure. We don't have to get too deep into the body without organs. Maybe you could just problematize the common takes on it and show what this contradiction is kind of between Deleuze and Guattari's positions on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not clear. It's been obscured by the way the books have been written. But we could just start very simply by talking about the difference between the way it's presented in Anti-Oedipus compared to the way it's presented in A Thousand Plateaus. So in Anti-Oedipus, the body without organs, just for lack of a better word, is just really big, right? Capital is the body without organs of capitalism. You know, the king's body is the body without organs of despotism. The earth is the body without organs of pre-state societies or non-state societies. And so there it has this sense of a surface on which desiring production is organized and also prevented, right? It has this anti-productive kind of feel in that. When we get to A Thousand Plateaus, right, the chapter, the plateau that's on that is called How to Make Yourself a Body Without Organs. And there it feels like a very sort of personal experimental project, right? You know, the opening lines, right? You have one or you have several. And so it looks like they're imagining that each person is continually producing and reproducing bodies without organs, and it's done as an experiment, and it can be botched, as in the case of the drug addict's body without organs, or the masochist body without organs. And so again, the question is, how can you produce yourself such that as many affects as possible circulate, right? Again, to sort of withdraw into Spinoza's language. So so to summarize, it looks like in Anti-Oedipus, body without organs plays this very large institutional role, something like strata in the Geology of Morals plateau. Whereas in A Thousand Plateaus, it looks like it is this individual experimental process that one continually undergoes. So You know, which of that is coming from Deleuze and which of it is coming from Guattari? I don't know. It's clear that Deleuze engages with Body Without Organs from Artaud as early as Logic of Sense, so before he meets Felix. And it's not clear what Felix took up. I don't know his work as well to be able to point to passages where he's talking about this to flesh it out more. It certainly feels to me like Anti-Oedipus has this more institutional account of the body without organs, and Thousand Plateaus has this much more personal. Now, ultimately, those are harmonizable, I think, or at least I would move in that direction as a first move, and if that failed, that would be fine. And say something like, well, even given the differences between the two works, the body without organs in both cases functions as a limit. And we could talk about, what that limit is and how that works, but what they're trying to think in both cases is the limit of desiring production in the case of Anti-Oedipus and the limit of circulation of affect or lines of flight or something like that in A Thousand Plateaus.
So I was under the impression that the body without organs is also in the virtual, or it's it's like what the extensive, like what we would see, empirically or experience phenomenologically, is all in a sort of sense downstream from the, the virtual. And then there's the intensive processes between sort of not mediating, but producing what we take as given. Right. And that the body without organs is like is it in the virtual, and that it's like that there's different kind of abstract machines that can then produce it into specific sort of ways of being or something?
So a couple of things, and I'm not sure I have a good answer to your question, but here's a first attempt. And not that you're saying this, but I just want to be clear about this. The body without organs, as I understand it, is not a ground for Deleuze and Guattari. It appears as a quasi-ground or a quasi-cause, they call it, in Anti-Oedipus, but it is not itself a ground. And so what's prior to that? Well, in Anti-Oedipus, it's desiring production. And I think in A Thousand Plateaus, it would be something like intensity. And so what's being described in both cases is the ways in which intensities coagulate into extensities, right? And the body without organs is the name of that limit that intensities run up against. And as they sort of bounce back or fold back on themselves, they spread out over this surface. And so I think philosophically, the project is trying to replace this concept of ground with something that is produced by a prior process. So how does the body without organs relate to the virtual and actual? And here I confess I have real difficulty sort of translating the language of difference and repetition to the language of capitalism and schizophrenia. Mm. Deleuze and Guattari abandon talk of the virtual and actual in A Thousand Plateaus, and it doesn't come back again until What is Philosophy? And so two possibilities here. Maybe there's more than two, but two occur to me at the moment. there's some kind of one-to-one translation. You know, the project of difference and repetition is the same as the project of capitalism and schizophrenia. And so there's pretty straightforward conversion that one could go through, like the virtual is the intensive and the actual is the extensive, and you know, assemblage or stratum or whatever is, or is where they meet, or is this process production or something like that. Maybe that's the case. The other possibility, and this is my view, although this is admittedly a minority view, I've taken a lot of crap for this, and that's okay. But I read A Thousand Plateaus as a critique of ideas found in difference and repetition. I think with Guattari, Deleuze is trying to go beyond the way he was thinking in difference and repetition. And so to my mind, you know, and this is to sort of hedge into the kind of work I'm doing now, I think difference and repetition remains too transcendental for the Deleuze of A Thousand Plateaus. And he's trying to think otherwise than the transcendental in A Thousand Plateaus. But this is super inside baseball. Maybe you don't want to go down this path. But anyway, so at the end of the day, I don't have a great answer for how does Body Without Organs relate to the virtual, for example. I'm not sure they're compatible vocabularies, or at least it's not clear to me. I'm sure somebody like Dan Smith could, you know, wave his hand and make it happen just like that. But I'm not there yet.
Well, I appreciate you for, I don't want to say calling me out, but problematizing my derivative impression of what's going on there, because that it, I think it is important to problematize and keep these things problems. And so I kind of want to get into I definitely want to get into this idea of death and what Deleuze brings and everything, but I don't know, we'll see if we have time, because like I said, Mikey asked a couple of questions. I don't know if you're familiar with his blog, but it's called The Dangerous Maybe. And he has referenced your work a few times on there. And, you know, what he does is he tries to flesh out his understanding of concepts. He tries to use, you know, key thinkers from continental philosophy, usually philosophy more broadly as well. And so it's a real resource and a treasure to us all. And then, I mean, that's, he's put me onto so many great works such as yours, because you were ultimately the key for unlocking how he approaches D&G. Now, his first question is, one concept of D&G's that remains blurry for a lot of us is that of the Erstat. Can you clarify this concept for us?
As far as I know, the first place this arises is in Anti-Oedipus. And so it's interesting. I think the key here is the work of Pierre Clasters, right? Especially Society Against the State, even though that comes out 2 years after Anti-Oedipus. Maybe Clasters had articles or something that they were also reading. I'd have to look at the notes in Anti-Oedipus, but here's how I take it. That any society, and thinking here particularly of non-state societies, thinks itself always in reference to its limits, right? So again, we're back to this question of limits in the body without organs. And so what is the limit of a non-state society? That is, what boundary would it have to cross in order to not be a non-state society anymore? And that boundary would be something like centralization of authority, hierarchy, things like that. And so what lies at the horizon of a non-state society is the state. And so for Deleuze and Guattari, following Clasters very explicitly, by the time we get to the War Machine in A Thousand Plateaus, is this notion that the state and non-state societies are equiprimordial, right? That there is this formal relation between the state and not the state that exists wherever there is a society. And I think it's that state form, that's the term they use in A Thousand Plateaus, is what they mean by the Erstaat, right? This idea of at what limit does a society become a state? And what mechanisms does a society use to ward off that kind of centralization and hierarchicization that becomes the state, right? That's the Erstaat, right? That's the fundamental form that gets imposed and ends up overcoding non-state societies.
Perfect, thank you. And then the other one is, what makes DNG's theory of desire, and I understand the irony, especially since you have this background in Derrida. This is a very American way of interviewing, just to be like question after question. But I just wanted to make sure we get these two before we can kind of really dig into the question that keeps me up at night. So what makes DNG's theory of desire so different from Lacan's theory of desire? Are these two theories totally incompatible, or is there a way to square the circle?
Yeah, great question. And you can see how carefully they're skirting around this issue in Anti-Oedipus. They're very clear to paint Freud with this brush. But very subtle with references to Lacan. And Guattari starts as a Lacanian, right? He was a client of Lacan's. And the initial task of Laborde was to sort of use Lacan to do institutional therapy. So there's this very tight relation between Lacanians and Guattari. And Deleuze and Lacan met, I think, when Deleuze was in Lyon at one point. The Parisian intellectual circle was very small and everybody knew everybody. And so, yeah, there was a lot of that going on. And then there was also sort of shenanigans too, when in their sessions, Lacan kept plying Guattari for information about the book that he was working on with Deleuze, right? This is all in Das's Intersecting Lives, right? The sort of urtext for anecdotes about Deleuze and Guattari. So anyway, let's talk about the difference first and then talk about whether that circle can be squared or not. So the straightforward difference is the difference between what Deleuze and Guattari call productive desire, that would be their view, and desire predicated on a lack, right? That's the fundamental distinction. And they think desire predicated on a lack runs throughout the entire history of Western thought, right? So the in Plato, right, the soul seeking the forms, right? In Augustine, you know, the heart is restless until it finds itself in God, right? So there's some kind of something that we're missing. And, you know, again, this is super obvious, and it's weird that to even call it into question. Like, the reason I want something is because I don't have it. I don't want things I already have. So that must be the structure of desire, that we're lacking something and we move, right? We're impelled to fill that lack. And so we seek the thing that we don't have. And so Deleuze and Guattari's position is, yes, of course, desire is predicated on a lack sometimes, but this is always a contingent and historical production, right? And so whenever we find desire predicated on a lack, that becomes a problem. That becomes a question asked, like, why that lack and what structures are producing that lack and supporting that lack, right? So it becomes a problem of genealogy rather than a transcendental structure that organizes experience. Okay, so in contrast to that, Deleuze and Guattari are arguing that, well, sure, sometimes in certain situations, which we would have to ask about, desire can be predicated on a lack, but more fundamental than that is productive desire. And so they have a couple of touchstones here. For me, Spinoza's the most straightforward one, right? Spinoza says desire is the essence of all things. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, the way that Deleuze reads Spinoza, what Spinoza means by that is that everything is always either connecting with something or breaking a connection with something. And you break a connection in order to make a connection with something else. And I spent years thinking about this. Like, this made no sense. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. And it was not clear to me until I had kids. And once I saw my kids playing, I suddenly understood productive desire. And I think, you know, we've all had this experience, even if you don't have kids of your own. If you watch a toddler play, you can imagine this in your mind. Toddlers running around with a toy in each hand. Just toddling around, toy in each hand, like just making the connection. What happens when the child sees a different toy? Throws the toys down and picks up the new thing. The child wasn't looking for the toy. The child didn't desire the toy as in it was something that it lacked. It just made a connection. And in order to make a new connection, it had to break the old connection. And the entirety of Anti-Oedipus is thinking about iterations of that very basic process, right? That's just what reality is, the continual making and breaking of connections. And this making and breaking of connections produces limits, which they call the body without organs. And then those connections get channeled and spread out across that body without organs, and you have society and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it's an entire metaphysics of desire based on the idea that desire is just the making and breaking of connections rather than being fundamentally predicated on a lack. Okay, before I get to the squaring the circle, I'll just pause there and see, are there questions or things you want to follow up on?
Nance, do you have anything? Wait, your mic's not working. Oh, you're muted on Zoom. Oh, okay.
Okay, am I working now?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm having tons of issues today. That, to me, rhymes with drive in a way, the surplus. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I start to get confused and my brain starts to shut down, because I immediately just want to say, oh, okay, they're just using polar language, and they're just missing each other. And I don't think that's right, but I also do see how it kind of rhymes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So, I mean, like, I don't want to be the Deleuze police, right, and say, no, there's no way that Deleuze and Lacan could ever go together. Like, yeah, there are paths one could take to use both of them. And, you know, from Deleuze's perspective, I think that would be the task, right? If you find something that's in Lacan that illuminates Deleuze or vice versa, and that's useful to you, that allows you to create something new, do that, right? Like, There's no final judge who's going to say, oh man, well, you got the Lacan wrong, man. I'm sorry. Just no dice, right? So yeah, just like combine and recombine and see what works and see what doesn't work. You know, and I don't mean that to be like a flip answer. Like, yeah, there are real textual issues. There would be really hard scholarship to be done to square the circle. So to speak. And for me and in my work, not that this has to be anybody else's project, I guess I can't can't quite get beyond the role of negation or the role of the lack in Lacan to sort of bring it back to Deleuze and Guattari. And I think I can do what I want to do without that. So I'm just going to go do that. But if you think, no, like there's, I can make something here. There's a fuzzy edge where they can be meshed. Like, do that. Do it all.
Well, and I think it seems that the part of what D and G want to get away from in getting away from this idea of lack would be the inference. It's just a lot of the Lacanian inferences that are behind the idea of drive. So, you know, and the idea that, say, OJA is like, has to do with like this retroactive, for the prohibit, you know, because of prohibition, because of the law, there is this lack, and then we have like this fantasy, and then like this is all these inferences, and they're kind of just like, we don't need all of that. We can just say everything's productive. Like, we don't need to add this backstory.
Or, I mean, I think we could say it this way, and this is the way they say it in Anti-Oedipus. Freud is right about everything. He's absolutely right. We're all Oedipalized. Oedipus is real. Like, this is, unassailable. Like, Freud was a genius. And you could read Anti-Oedipus as kind of a recovery of Freud. Except what Freud took, all the structures Freud took to be transcendental, universal, and ahistorical are in fact produced historically and contingently. So yeah, read Freud. He was right, but he was only right about this particular slice of society. And so part of our task is to figure out what are the conditions that led to this particular arrangement of desire, this particular lack. Like, why is it that our desire is captured by the family? Well, we'd have to tell a story about how families get privatized under capitalism, and about labor and the way labor gets detached from the land, and right, and the way the state overcodes, right? And that's the story they want to tell in chapter 3 of Anti-Oedipus, right? So it's not that Freud was wrong, and, you know, maybe we can include Lacan here, maybe we couldn't. As I said, they're very cagey about Lacan in Anti-Oedipus, but for Freud, they start with the acknowledgement he's right, just he's not as right as he thought he was, right? He didn't discover universal structures of the unconscious. He discovered a process, and then he assumed that the way in which that process got captured in contemporary society is the way that it fundamentally is. And Deleuze and Guattari are saying, no, what's more fundamental is productive desire. And so what we need to do is give a genealogy, tell a story about how productive desire gets captured in this very specific way.
I think that's enough for us on these two questions to think about, and probably, hopefully, we'll want to come back. And I would love for you to have an opportunity to meet Mikey. Sadly, he would normally be here, but right now he's working, and so he's listening while driving a truck. Drive safe out there. It's probably snowy, and you know, it's been wrecked out here. Where are you located?
Roanoke, Virginia.
Roanoke, Virginia. Okay. And what's the weather like out there right now?
It's chilly, and we had some snow. I'm in the mountains of Virginia, so it's very pleasant. Nothing serious, classes weren't canceled or anything like that. So it's all good. I'm actually happy to see some snow. We haven't had any here in a couple of years, so that's good.
And you said this is the first week of classes for you all?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad, because on the first week of classes, I'm a discussion leader for two sections as an adjunct, and both my sections were canceled during the first week. And then this week they were almost canceled. The morning classes my wife teaches were canceled. Mine were not. So it's dicey out here though, because people are getting stuck everywhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, the streets are clear here. Nobody's getting stuck. It's all pretty anodyne.
All right. So now the question about death. In fact, I'll use as a bridge the fact that I was just talking about whether Heidegger would say this is, you know, this is idle talk. That's and right. The you know, falling is fleeing, right? It's fleeing from that resoluteness, that anticipatory resoluteness, and this kind of like taking seriously the fact that all of our life, insofar as it can be meaningful or deliberate, is in reference to the necessary impossibility or of any more possibilities, right? I don't know so much how to bring that into dialogue with Hegel, much less how Deleuze would factor in, but you've done all this work on it. So I want to give you, I guess, some time to talk about that.
Sure. So yeah, it did seem like, you know, in a superficial way that Hegel and Heidegger had opposing conceptions of death, right? So for Heidegger, you know, death is individualizing, you know, one's own most possibility. It happens without meat sign. All these, you know, sort of very individualizing structures of death for Heidegger. Hegel, on the other hand, seemed like, and I'm just speaking of the phenomenology, though I might be willing to make broader claims here. For Hegel, death is a communal problem, right? That death is clearly this natural negation. And so what needs to happen for a society to progress, become more rational, is to convert that natural negation into a spiritual negation. And so you can read the phenomenology as this process of ever more fully spiritual negations of death, right? So master slave, you don't get very far, but by the time you get to revealed religion, where you have this entire institutional process and the Eucharist, which, you know, celebrates this death of God every day, that's a fully spiritualized negation as far as Hegel is concerned. And then this gets taken up into the conceptual language of philosophy, right? That's just picture thinking for Hegel, right? The real action happens in philosophy for him. So we sort of have this, you know, in very bare terms, an individualist account of death versus a communal account of death. And so I was thinking, well, maybe this opposition is structured like an antinomy in the Kantian sense, right? Maybe we have two valid arguments for opposed conclusions. It's like, okay, well, what does one do with an antinomy? And Kant says, well, there are two ways you can solve an antinomy. Either the antinomy is dynamical, in which case both sides are true, or the antinomy is dynamical, in which case, or sorry, mathematical, in which case both sides are false. Like, okay, well, maybe we could think about philosophy since Hegel as offering either mathematical or dynamical solutions to this impasse, right? The individual versus the communal on death. And maybe we could think about these two opposed sides as either mourning or melancholia, right? So I'm using Freud's essay, Mourning and Melancholia here. And I argue that Heidegger presents a melancholic account of death. And his melancholy lies precisely in the fact that one is never done with one's own death, right? It just keeps returning over and over again. For Hegel, the negative is always sublated only to reappear again. And so this seems more like mourning in Freud's sense, where, you know, there we have a love object, and the love object disappears, and we withdraw cathexes from the object, and we reorient our psychic topography, and then reattach to a new love object, right? That's the dialectic for Hegel, is this process of attaching to a love object and withdrawing the loss and reattaching, right? So it's this never-ending process for Hegel. And so then we can begin to think about sort of contemporary accounts of death, and whether they're mournful or melancholic, or the way in which this antinomy gets solved. I don't spend a lot of time on this, but I propose that, for example, I think someone like Derrida presents a dynamical solution to the antinomy. He thinks both sides are true. And I think this is very clear in The Gift of Death, for example. And then my sort of contribution or the insertion of Deleuze here is that Deleuze is the only person who presents a mathematical solution to the antinomy. He thinks both sides are false, neither mourning nor melancholia. And he thinks both sides are false because both sides are predicated on a desire predicated on a lack. So if we replace desire predicated on a lack with productive desire, we get a new account of death that does not fall prey to this antinomy or dissolves the antinomy. So that's sort of, that's the whole book in a nutshell, sort of just working out all of those steps, you know, first with the Heidegger and melancholia, and then with Hegel and mourning, and then finally Deleuze. With a new account of desire, we get a new account of death.
That was amazing. Thank you so much. That's That's you made me want to read the book. I hope to be able to get to it here in the next couple months and bring you back on, hopefully for a conversation where Mikey can also be here as well. Nance, do you have any closing thoughts or questions for Brent?
No, I do think you were actually very clear. And laying out, I guess, kind of the differences between Anti-Oedipus and A Thousand Plateaus with regard to Body Without Organs. And that's not an easy thing to do. So thank you for being able to lay that out. I'm very much looking forward to getting into your work and reading through it, because the last hour was very clear, very concise. So thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. It's been great. And I'm happy to come back on anytime. Talk about death and desire or anything else you might be interested in.
Wonderful. And, you know, it's been an absolute honor. So thank you so much. Everybody, we'll be right back after this for our conversation with Daniel from OG Rose. Brent, thank you so much. Take care.
Yep. Thanks.
We cannot do direct revolution, but the only way to lay the foundation for it is to do what you are doing to move the underground. It's a theoretically correct title.
Welcome to Theory Underground, a place for workers with earbuds who are tired of the bullshit and just want to get down to it. Big ideas, rigorous thinking, and ultimately liberation from necessity.
Research at Theory Underground focuses on what is most important for understanding our current situation. Theory of the subject, capital, time energy theory, critical media theory, CMT, and the most essential critiques necessary for understanding why the theory, ideology, and common sense of influencers left to right misses the mark.
Theory Underground is coming to a city near you. Besides a commitment to publishing certain underground theorists and popularizing certain fundamental concepts, we have toured the United States and are touring Europe to promote our ideas, courses, and publications.
You've been reading Underground Theory.
Amazing book. I'm a publisher and an editor. I run a review of books. Literally, it's my living. This is the best editing collection I've ever read.
Okay, picture this scene. America, early 2021. An Amazon warehouse worker arises from the emerging Underground Theory internet scene to create spaces for untimely topics and concerns that are too often neglected or kept in isolation today. Joined by a revolving cast of underground theorists, academics, and critics, he establishes what will become Theory Underground, a teaching, research, and publishing platform by and for working class intellectuals, autodidacts, and academics who want to do more than they're able to do within the confines of academia. That warehouse worker's name is David McKerricker, and his book Time Energy is his first major contribution to the world of theory. It was recently reprinted with a foreword by none other than Slavoj Žižek, who also contributed to Theory Underground's latest book.
My Bible, it's an excellent book.
A collection of essays called Underground Theory.
What you just heard is an excerpt from the Strange Exiles podcast, episode 23, where Bram from Strange Exiles interviewed me and Mikey. For those who don't know, Mikey is the author of the Dangerous Maybe blog. We are publishing one of his books here shortly at Theory Underground. He's also a lecturer at Theory Underground, and he's someone I've been friends and a collaborator with for over 10 years. But most importantly for you all, he's a fantastic lecturer, and it's a crime that he has to do wage labor right now. One of the long-term goals of Theory Underground has been now for a couple of years to hashtag Free Mikey. That is something that I've been really pushing, but first, obviously, I have to get freed myself so the two of us are able to do this because, you know, as Mikey said, build it and they will come. Well, I tried and I built a website and platform. I had my own app and everything, but it's been really buggy and it's more than one person can handle. And that's, you know what, a really good lesson for me. And so for now, what we're doing is moving it to a temporary intermediary platform until we are able to get some more serious funding. And ultimately, we want to be in a place like this, a real brick and mortar digital nomadic mecca where people can come from all over the world. But also, the app was really expensive. And so by quitting it, I am now able to save a lot of money. And with the help of my patrons and the students at Theory Underground, especially the monthly subscribers, I am officially able to quit Amazon and do Theory Underground full time. So thank you so much, everybody. This is one huge step forward. My way of giving back to everybody is by promoting everyone who is at a current tier to the benefits of the tier above them, as far as subscribers go. And also rolling out a new lower tier. And so check out the tier subscription setup. And if you're not interested in taking the courses or what's being offered for subscribers and you want to support anyway, check out the Patreon. Finally, just stay tuned for more information on the tour in Europe during the month of May 2024 and the conference in Mexico during the last weekend of October 2024. If you want to be there, hit me up ASAP. Let's get talking, because it's happening very soon. All right, bye bye. Special shout out to Nikolai, Sahil, and Zotsandra, as well as all of my other amazing patrons over at patreon.com.